Welcome to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation, hosted by Elizabeth Heaton. On this show, the team of experts from Bright Horizons College Coach aim to demystify college admissions and finance. From choosing the right college, developing a payment strategy, creating a high school plan, and more. Each episode will help guide your family through the various steps of the process. Now, here is your host.
Hello, welcome everyone to today's episode of Getting In, a College Coach Conversation. I'm Sally Ganga from College Coach. Happy fall. It's a sunny, crisp fall day here in Connecticut. It's finally acting like fall instead of 70 degrees in November. But I hope everybody's enjoying the beautiful weather. This will be a really fun show. Our second segment will be with Bo Benson, admission officer at Northeastern. He'll be telling us about all their different campuses and programs. And for the third segment, College Coach finance expert Wally Boudet will be telling us about quirky scholarships. There are some strange ones out there, so this should be entertaining. But first, and those of you who are watching this on YouTube or from our website, you'll see that right on the screen is Michael Simons, attorney and partner at CMBG3, to the third power, law firm in Boston, who is here to talk to us about becoming an attorney. So welcome, Michael.
Hey, Sally, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Really interested in hearing your perspective really broadly, but I think first and foremost, it would be good if students knew generally what it meant to be an attorney, because I think they get all their information from television. Like they think that if you're good at arguing with your parents, then you should be a lawyer. Like I hear that all the time. And because my own mother was a lawyer, I'm quite aware that it's actually more writing. And I was like, you know, she said actually being a good writer is even more helpful than being a good in-person arguer, although there's certainly a place for that too. So what are some of the things you think people should be aware of if they're considering becoming an attorney?
Sure. For me, the most pressing thing, if you want to be an attorney, I think is to the way you approach problem solving. It's got to be methodical. You want to, think about how am I going to, deal with this problem? What are the pros? What are the cons? A lot of the times, and it depends very much so on what area of law you end up going into. Mm-hmm. Whether you are that courtroom person or whether you are the person say, no, I'm more comfortable, drawing up contracts, or no, I might be more comfortable, researching and writing, motions, doing motion practice. It really, to me, the biggest thing comes down to is how do you take a problem? How do you look at it from, try to look at it from all different angles so that you can give good counseling to your clients, and give them advice on, look, this is how I think you should handle this.
Mm-hmm. I would think it would be also very important to be able to explain to all different kinds of people the pros and cons of everything.
You do very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, the term for you're often referred to as a counselor, mm-hmm. and that's the way you're often referred to sometimes in court. And that's exactly what you're doing. You are offering, it's not always, standing up in court, pointing the finger at someone and saying, he did it, and you should find him guilty. It's really a lot of the time is doing exactly that, being a counselor, advising your clients on, look, this is what you need to think about, when you're dealing with this particular issue or this particular case. And these are the possible, ramifications if you go this way or if you go that way. Mm-hmm. And saying, and a lot of times to me, it's important not just to simply point out all the possibilities, but to give them at the end of the day advice on, look, based on everything, this is what I think you should do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But supporting them whether they follow your advice or not.
Absolutely. And that's inevitable. And that's fine. I mean, I think, I deal with a lot of sometimes insurance carriers for part of the work I do. And one of the things that I've always heard from them, and it's most critical, is they don't care if you make a recommendation and they disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to happen, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But what they want is you to look at the situation, make a recommendation, take a stand. And they're going to respect that, and clients will respect that much more than if you simply say, well, you could do this or you could do that, you could do A or could do B, mm-hmm. and it's up to you. They know it's up to them.
Mm-hmm.
What they want to hear is, okay, I've looked at the options. Here's what I think your best bet is. Here's what I recommend you do.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be much more impressed with you and much happier with your service. mm-hmm. if you actually do that, as opposed to just being wishy-washy.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. It's not that dissimilar from what we do, where I'm like, okay, what's your goal?
Right.
Like, what's your goal? Like, we have to start with what your goal is, and then here's my recommendation. And then, you know, I would say a good 50% of the time, students don't follow it, or they'll follow it partially, which is fine. You know, it's their process, and that's good. But I think that you're actually right, that they like to hear some more concrete advice if they can get it. If they're clear about their own goals, then usually that's something I can do.
Sure.
Yeah. So what are things that I would think particularly college students can do to prepare themselves for, to be a good candidate for law school?
So, you know, one of the great things about law school is, you know, unlike, let's say, medical school, there is no core requirement, you know, set mm-hmm. path that you need to have. You know, you don't have to take organic and inorganic chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, law
school. Thankfully, right?
Thankfully, exactly. which was part of the reason why I never became a doctor. but honestly, you know, I've known people who have followed so many different paths before they ended up in law and in law school. So it doesn't matter if you are a history major or an economics major. I know people who have engineering backgrounds, which actually turns out to be pretty useful if you want to do certain areas of law, mm-hmm. Like patent and trademark law. Engineering background is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I had a political science background. It's a great thing that there is no set path. And I think that what that allows you to do is, when you're in college, you know, once you've, you know, taken care of the core requirements that you need to take care of that are, you know, set by your school, you can experiment and you mm-hmm. can, you know, boldly go into these different areas and try out different things and do what makes you happy and what you think you might find interesting. Mm-hmm. And then if you decide that law school is the path you want to go down, it doesn't matter. You know, mm-hmm. whatever background you have is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Are there certain things that are helpful, you know, or activities? You know, look, if your thought is, hey, I want to be a litigator, if you know in your heart, say, hey, look, I want to be the guy, I want to be the person standing up in a courtroom and arguing cases, then yeah, join your debate team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think, hey, I'm more interested in trying to negotiate, you know, resolutions, you know, among parties who are in conflict, well, you know, then something like Model UN, mm-hmm. that's kind of an interesting path, you know, to get some experience in and get a feel for you know, conflict resolution. You know, and once you're in law school, everyone has a certain core requirements that they have to take. So there will be contracts and torts and property law and criminal law and constitutional law. And that takes up probably the first year to year and a half of the 3-year law school program.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they do that is quite frankly, it's again the same idea of, a core in college, which is expose you to a whole bunch of areas, and that will help you figure out, okay, this interests me, this doesn't. It certainly worked for me. I mean, I came through it and said, okay, yeah, I don't want to do criminal law. It's not for me. But then again, you know, but on the other hand, it's like, oh, I really enjoy civil procedure and I love, you know, torts. So mm-hmm. maybe that's the area I should go into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people think, often students think they know what they want to do, but they mm-hmm. haven't been exposed to everything. I mean, how could you know
exactly.
more broadly, yeah. you know? Now, are there people who should or shouldn't pursue a career in law? I'm just kind of curious if you have a sense of that. Like, are there, I mean, I know that it might be hard to predict, but are there people who kind of went to law school, started in law? Is there any consistent pattern with those who started in law and said, I don't want to do this?
You know, I don't know if there's a consistent pattern, but I think like any job out there, there are times when you find yourself thinking it's not what it was going to be, or maybe mm-hmm. just the area of law that you're practicing is not quite what you wanted. And yeah, people, it's inevitable. You know, there are always going to be people who say, you know, gee, this isn't really what I want to do with my life. You know, I don't want to practice law. But the one thing I've always said about that is that the reason why law school is kind of great is, I think I alluded to earlier, that part of law school, what it does is teach you how to creatively think about problem solving
mm-hmm.
and think about different ways to approach problems that you're faced with. A law degree is wonderful if you want to practice law, if it's necessary. But it's a wonderful thing to have because of the way that they train your mind, it's applicable in so many other areas. So if you get your law degree and you say, you know, boy, maybe you practice, maybe you don't practice, but you say, I don't want to practice, or I don't enjoy it, I don't really, you know, like being a lawyer, a traditional lawyer, you've still got a phenomenal background to go into business. Mm-hmm. You've got a phenomenal background to, you know, provide, you know, counsel to, you know, other businesses or other companies. I've seen people with law degrees do a whole variety of things. It's you don't have to think of it as, well, if I go to law school, I must practice law and be a litigator. Mm-hmm. Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Yeah, I actually have a friend who works on Wall Street doing, I think, like risk assessment, which
sure.
Her law background is very helpful for.
Yep. Yep. So. That's a huge thing. People end up in, whether it's Wall Street, you know, insurance companies, mm-hmm. you know, risk assessment is a huge area that, again, you're not technically practicing law. You know, you're not looking up cases and doing that, but you've been trained to think a certain way and to approach problem solving a certain way that's really applicable across the board.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. But now let's get on to kind of some of the tougher stuff. Like, absolutely, I think law school can be useful in so many different ways, but there have been gluts in the past of lawyers, and it looks like there might be another glut, right? And so let's talk about, like, do we need more lawyers? You know, is it a good idea to go to law school? And I know that depends on the person, but what would you say are some of the pros and cons?
Sure. Honestly, I there will always be waves. I think it's inevitable in any profession. You know, there's going to be periods where, hey, this is the hot thing. There are tons of jobs. People are hiring. And then you get to a point where, no, there's a bit of a glut now, and it's going to cool off a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen that before in the legal profession. I mean, certainly, you know, there have been times when I said, oh, why don't they just close the law schools for, you know, for 2 years or 3 years, and, you know, and then let everything catch up. But I wouldn't worry about it. I really wouldn't. If, you know, anyone who's looking, you know, looking at colleges now, well, okay, that's 4 years. It's 4 years from now before you even start law school.
Mm-hmm.
Add 3 more years to that to get through law school. Isn't it? We're now talking, there's a glut, you know, potentially, you know, coming down the pike right now. Okay. But someone who's coming into college now is not going to be even looking at the legal job market for 7 years
mm-hmm.
from now. And I don't think anyone is predicting that, oh, it's all doom and gloom, you know, come 7 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
There will always be cycles. There will always be jobs. And there always will be opportunities. Now, they may not be in the areas that you thought you'd end up in. You know, for example, just to personalize it, when I was in law school, I took, you know, after I got through my core requirements, I took a bunch of courses about to deal with healthcare law. Mm-hmm. And that was really what I was interested in, what I thought I was going to end up doing. You know, lo and behold, what's my first job out of law school? It's not in healthcare law.
Mm-hmm.
and then I realized, oh, gee, I'm not doing what I thought I was going to be doing, but I'm enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of set me on my path. And then, you know, over the years, I've worked in all different types of areas. And have actually had the opportunity to do some work in healthcare law as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I would never worry about, well, gee, the job market in the next year or two doesn't look good. You know, they're predicting it's not going to be good for lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's okay. One, you're not in law school right now.
Yeah.
And two, there are always new areas of law being developed.
Mm-hmm.
Always new areas of law that are coming to the forefront. Just as technology advances, there's going mm-hmm. to be, you know, new areas that people haven't practiced in before.
Mm-hmm.
So there will always be something out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government doesn't really know what to do with all the advances in Silicon Valley. I mean, they're lagging far behind something, you know. So I think I would put in a caveat. I mean, well, please feel free to push back on this, but I've read about sort of law school diploma mills. So, you know, if you can go to like a kind of, it doesn't have to be an Ivy. You know what I mean? There's a lot of good law schools out there, but there are law schools that are where the rate of passage of the bar exam is very, very low. You know, things, I mean, there's always going to be people who fail no matter how good the law school, but like the passage rate is low. Those, I would caution students about taking on a lot of debt. Like, do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. So I was I'm a product of, I went to a private undergrad. I went to Brown University in Rhode Island, and then I went to University of Florida for law school.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason I went to University of Florida, it was twofold. One, it was a lot less expensive, you know, even as an out-of-stater. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate that, and I don't know if this is the situation anymore. I've been out for practicing for about 30 years. But, you know, after my first semester of law school, I was able to get in-state tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And then my tuition dropped even more.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. I think it is critical. It doesn't matter. And what's always been important to me is it doesn't really matter where you go. It's what you put into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a firm believer that you can get a phenomenal, you know, legal education at a state school. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to go to Harvard Law. You don't have to go to Yale.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and quite frankly, with all due respect, a lot of the attorneys, some of the attorneys I've known, the best attorneys have gone to schools that I've worked with or have had cases against, have gone to law schools that weren't considered, you know, the elite, you know, law schools.
Mm-hmm.
They come from all walks of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my mother went to Loyola Marymount Law School, which is a very fine law school, but not, you know, it's not Yale. You're not getting Supreme Court justice clerkships, you know, which who cares? That's not what she wanted to do anyway.
Right.
So she did just fine with that particular degree. So
I was going to say, I think it's really critical. It's not where you go, it's what you put into it.
Mm-hmm.
That really is the most important thing. I think wherever you go, you're going to end up, and I feel the same way about, you know, I'm talking about college a little bit, but, you know, wherever you go, if you put the time in, you know, you will find your friends there. You will find your people. You will find your path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you know, having a fancy name on a degree might get you an initial interview that you may or may not have gotten otherwise, but that's as far as it gets you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, beyond that, you still have to, you know, you have to do the work. You have to be good. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be responsible. It doesn't matter, you know, if I, you know, walk in with my, you know, a fancy degree from, you know, Columbia Law, but I'm not very good.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Maybe I got an interview or maybe I got my first job because I had a fancy, you know, degree behind me, but it's not going to keep you working. It's not going to keep you practicing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case from for undergrad too. So, you know, I guess with just one last kind of thing, I mean, do you have any sort of sense of maybe best or worst things about being a lawyer? Like, I mean, you can speak completely personally on this because everybody's sure. going to have a different opinion. Like, what are the, and I realize you're a working lawyer, so maybe your law firm does, you know, you can't say your colleague, right? But just in general, what are some of the like best things about being a lawyer and maybe some things to think about if you're thinking about joining the law?
Sure. So, I am very fortunate that I really do love my colleagues. So, and I mean that they're great. Mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate. To me, it's the things that I really enjoy. For example, I really enjoy cross-examining witnesses, whether it's at a deposition or a trial. It's fun. It's fun to basically take their testimony, take, you know, the documents that get produced in the course of a, you know, discovery in a case, and figure out ways, you know, to prove my client's position, you know, and to, you know, dig into and really take apart someone else on the stand. I know it sounds mean, but it's actually it's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I you know, really enjoy as well is, you know, I enjoy working with my clients pretty closely. I enjoy working with expert witnesses, which I do quite a bit. And part of the reason I really enjoy that is it's a learning process. So I do a lot of toxic tort litigation. And as a result, I've had to learn, you know, principles of engineering and principles of toxicology and principles of mineralogy and, you know, medical things that, hey, I didn't go to med school, but suddenly I know a heck of a lot about, you know, about lung function, you know, and lung-related diseases. I'm always learning something. So that's the thing I like best about my practice.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like one of those jobs where you're always going to be learning something.
It is. And, you know, are there days when I sit there and I say, oh, why did I do this? You know, why didn't I do something else? You know, why didn't I become a vet? You know, sure. There, you know, but you're going to have that with any job. There are always going to be days when I think you're going to feel it's a grind. You know, mm-hmm. it happens. It happens, but it's going to happen whether you're a practicing attorney. It's going to happen whether you're a physician. It's going to happen whether you are a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, Michael. This has been great.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now we're going to take a short break, and when we return, I'll be talking with Bo Benson of Northeastern University.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
College admissions can be stressful, but Bright Horizons College Coach is here to help. Our college experts, who worked in admissions and financial aid at some of the nation's most selective institutions, offer ethical, customized assistance based on each student's individual strengths and interests. Students receive one-on-one guidance throughout the process, and our 100% success rate means all of our students have been accepted to college. Visit getintocollege.com to learn more. When it's time to go through the college admissions process, look to Bright Horizons College Coach for ethical guidance and customized support. Our educators will get to know your students' ambitions and talents, help highlight hard-won achievements, and create a plan for getting into a top-choice school. That plan includes helping your student choose classes and extracurriculars, create a college list, brainstorm and edit essays, and navigate college financing options. Visit getintocollege.com to learn more.
We're with you wherever Alexa and Google are. At home, in the car, on your smart TV, and your connected devices.
Hey, Alexa.
Hey, Google. Play my favorite Voice America podcast on TuneIn.
It's just that easy. But make sure you actually mention the name of the podcast show to make it work.
You are listening to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation. To submit a question for an upcoming listener Q&A segment or to suggest an idea for a future segment, please send an email to gettingin.voiceamerica@gmail.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome, Bo. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right. So I've been doing this. I've been working with College Coach for 14 years. I've been doing the radio show for multiple, can't remember, but probably at least five. And I had no idea that Northeastern had so many different programs and campuses. Like, I knew about some of them, but what is going on over there? That place is exploding. So yeah, tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, it's become a very popular place to apply. Last year we had 91,000 students apply. So it's ultimately, we've developed all these different programs so that we can bring in more students, to the university. There are a lot of amazing applicants who, you know, before when we just had our campus in Boston, we really weren't able to kind of grow. So now this has kind of given us the flexibility to expand and welcome more students into the Husky community. So right now our programs include, you could obviously spend your first year in Boston, but then we have two other kind of alternate programs for students that are Boston-based, or they'll receive their degree from Boston, Northeastern University in Boston. And those are our NUIN program. And the NUIN program is, it's a fall semester abroad, and then you come back to Boston for the spring semester. So your fall semester could be in Rome, it could be in London, it could be in Madrid, Berlin, a number of cities, and you spend your fall abroad, and then you come back in January and spend your spring in Boston. The next program we have is called Global Scholars, the Global Scholars program. And Global Scholars is essentially a first year away from Boston. And so you would spend your fall semester either in London at our campus in London, Oakland, California at our campus in Oakland. So either one, and then you flip-flop for the spring. So in the spring, if you're in London for the fall, you go to Oakland for the spring, and ultimately you would return to Boston as a sophomore. So it allows us to kind of, you know, get students out there, experiencing the world around them, experiencing other Northeastern campuses, while allowing us to still maintain and kind of bring in our standard class size here in Boston so that we're not bringing in too large of a class.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of fascinating. Is there any kind of like cohort man, like, I just think about, so the pluses of this, I think, are obvious, which is like you're in these like very exciting settings, whether it's London or frankly, Oakland. I think they're both really exciting places to go, not to mention places like Berlin, et cetera.
Right.
But at the same time, a lot of what happens in a student's first year is really bonding with fellow students. You know, everybody's new, everybody's making new friends. And so just kind of curious, like how that is managed.
Yeah. So, I mean, on one end, there's an amazing student affairs team that's really kind of building that experience for students while they're abroad. But at the same time, I also like to mention the size of these programs. Typically, when you do like a spring semester abroad, it could be with maybe 25 to 40 students. It's a very small cohort. With NUN, each site is anywhere from 125 to 250 students. So it's much larger. Global Scholars is about 700 across the two cohorts. So they're not small programs. And so we really do focus in on, you know, finding students that are going to be a good fit for it as well. We're not looking for a student who will essentially, you know, come back to Boston and be afraid of the fact that they might not be able to find friends. But we really, in the admissions process, target students who are going to come back to Boston and they're going to be excited to jump right in. Mm-hmm. We look for students who are really going to jump in head first. And so it's a combination of things. It's student affairs, building programming for them. It's the size of the cohort that we're enrolling. And it's the type of student that we look for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're going to, I mean, let's face it, it's a pretty good self-selection process where if you're going to do this program, you're going to be pretty adventurous.
And I would say I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago, but the student body president was someone who started in one of these programs. So it's not like you're not seeing students excel. You know, they're coming in and they're performing at the same levels. And in terms of their involvement, we're seeing it at I would say, a fairly similar level. The only difference would be in those programs, we can't have recruited athletes just because they need to be here in the fall. So the only area that we really can't compare it with is athletics.
Right, right. So how does it work around the co-op program at Northeastern, which is really how I think of Northeastern? Like, I think if a student wants a co-op, Northeastern is, it's not the only school, but it's really a big destination. It might even be the best known school that has that kind of a co-op program.
It's the oldest co-op program in the country. So, the great thing with co-op is students are not allowed to begin co-op until the second semester of their sophomore year.
Right.
So none of these programs will kind of negatively impact or prevent them from going on co-op. They'll be able to come back to Boston. They can take a co-op prep course. So, you know, a zero credit course the semester before their co-op that allows them to go kind of prepare for it, interview for it, get hired and whatnot, go through the whole co-op application and hiring process. They can do that as soon as they come back to Boston in that first semester. Mm-hmm. And then they can be off and on their co-op in the second semester. Mm-hmm. So none of it will prevent students from going on co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might make the student a little bit more, you know, a different type of student who's applying to kind of a particular co-op because they're coming in with these global experiences and a different background than our usual student body.
Mm-hmm. I took a gap year abroad before I started college. And I will say that when I came back, I mean, I'm obviously tooting my own horn here, but I felt much kind of calmer about the social scene than a lot of my friends did. I wasn't worried about making friends. I'd already been to a new place. Like everything, sort of the social anxiety aspect of college just was not really a thing for me. I was like, everything's going to be fine. It's already been fine. I've already been in a new environment. And I have to think that that kind of thing would help with the co-op program too, because I mean, it's hard as someone that age to go into a work environment.
I mean, I give our students a lot of respect. I would be terrified looking back. You know, they're at a very young age preparing themselves to go in and work for, you know, Fortune 500 companies and not just go in and make photocopies and, you know, get someone else's Starbucks. They are actually there working on projects. You know, we had the stories that you hear of what these students are doing at such a young age is incredible. But I totally understand the kind of hesitation and kind of fear. I will say with NUN in particular, kind of talking about NUN and co-op, we actually, all NUN students, when they come back to Boston, will live together in the spring semester. Mm-hmm. So I also think that creates a really nice bond that allows students to prepare for kind of what's next. And also, I will say, our student body is very collaborative. It's very it's obviously hands-on since there's so much experiential learning built into the curriculum, but it's a very collaborative student body. You constantly hear about one student who is helping another student to interview for their co-op as their kind of replacement. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see. The students really want to support one another and they really do a great job. Or maybe that's the students that I get to see every day, but they're really a very, very supportive and kind of collaborative group.
So can students who are in the co-op program, and we should note that you don't have to be in the co-op program to attend Northeastern. I think that's important to note, although it is a great reason to go to Northeastern. But if you are doing the co-op program, can you go abroad later, like on one of the off semesters? Is that still an option?
Yes, or you can do your co-op abroad. We have a growing number about, I think, right before the pandemic, I'm not sure the current percent, but right before the pandemic, about 15% of our co-ops were outside of the U.S. Mm. So if you want to go to Shanghai or London and be on your co-op, you can absolutely do that. But if you want to do co-op and kind of a global experience in a separate semester, that's absolutely possible. A lot of students will do that. And we also have a ton of summer programs that are available that are called Dialogues of Civilization. And they are kind of specialized 4 to 6 week summer programs that are they're built for Northeastern students by Northeastern faculty. And they're very particular to a teacher's interests, academic interests, and they change every year. And they're really based around the location that they go to. So, you know, there could be a dialogue about financial markets of Europe. And maybe you're going to London for 2 weeks, Paris 2 weeks, and Frankfurt for 2 weeks, getting credits that way. So we have a lot of students, if they want to keep co-op and abroad separate, they might do a dialogue of civilization instead.
That actually brings up the next question, which I was wondering if the all these different campuses are impacted or impact the course offerings. Like, I know you have one in Silicon Valley. That must be purposeful, right? That's all about computing.
Absolutely. I mean, so we have two, I forgot to mention earlier, we have two separate campuses that are Northeastern University campuses where you can go and spend all 4 years for your degree. So one is in Silicon Valley and just outside of Silicon Valley and in Oakland. And then we also have one in London, England. And so both those locations are very focused in on the kind of local industry and really use that to their advantage when they're, you know, kind of when they're building the academic programming there. Our inaugural, our very first class for both campuses will be this fall. So we're very excited about that. And they're separate from our regional campus. We have a lot of campuses. We also have regional campuses, which are mostly graduate programs. So Silicon Valley, San Francisco, Miami, all of those are really home to graduate campuses or courses. However, our students, if they're in those locations for co-op, can very much take advantage of the courses down there if they want to take a course while they're there on co-op, for example. But it gives us a kind of a base for co-op. It allows us to kind of have, you know, an outpost where our students can kind of gather and come together when they need to while they're away from Boston on their co-op.
And so this is really all primarily in person. Like, this is not virtual. A lot of campuses have gone more to virtual, but it sounds like the effort really is to keep this in person.
I mean, and it's largely been in person. Some of our regional campuses will have online, you know, graduate certificates. But I would say the bulk of our online programming is really coming out of Boston. The regional campuses, I think the real benefit there is to bring people together, you know, in other parts of the country who may not necessarily be, you know, close to Boston or able to get here for class. So we really try and keep those campuses, I would say, largely in person, but definitely some graduate kind of online programs as well.
Yeah. And I know that more and more college students are kind of clamoring for that Silicon Valley experience. They see it as being advantageous. So, you know, and really Oakland isn't, well, it's pretty far with traffic, but I mean, Silicon Valley has expanded beyond the boundaries of Silicon Valley too. So,
right. And so Silicon Valley it's obviously separate from, we have a campus in Silicon Valley. I was talking about, we have now a full kind of 4-year degree.
Yeah. Mills on the former. Yeah.
Mills College. But, and I will say, I mean, with co-op, though, it really is an advantage. I mean, over 50% of our students get a job offer from their co-op employer. So, I mean, that's huge to be able to say that by the time you're graduating, you know, one of your co-op employers may, you know, offer you something that's really outstanding.
And some students are really ready to get to work. I mean, I know I personally wanted a more traditional college experience. I wanted to talk about things that had no impact on my life, like, you know, or business. Like, but I've talked to students who, I talked to one student who got into Northeastern, but honestly hadn't done a ton of research on it. And when I told her more about the co-op program, she said, oh my God, I should go there. And I'm like, yeah, how did you not know this? You know, she just kind of knew it was a good school in Boston, you know? But when I told, she said, I really just want to get to work. I'm not so interested, you know, in you know, like she wanted to get to work and she acknowledged the need for broader education. But, and I said, well, gosh, Northeastern sounds about as perfect for you as I can imagine.
Yeah, no, it's funny. The number of students, and I would say it's regional around the world. The number of students who come to us or come to events and they have no idea what co-op is and they think it's a food store or it's an apartment board. And so we have to very much do a lot of work explaining it and kind of describing it and making sure that everyone is aware of what it is, because it's definitely not a word that translates easily from country to country.
Yes.
but it really is. I mean, it's there's a huge value in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we should have. I very much enjoyed my small liberal arts and sciences college, but and I think they have acknowledged the need to get us out into the workforce a little bit more. So a little bit of both, at least. So I'm just curious, too, like just to kind of wrap things up. How does admission work to the different programs? Is there any difference in the admission process? Are there any differences in selectivity, anything like that?
So we admit, so all students apply to Northeastern through the Common Application, and then they have to, or the Coalition Application, and they then have to indicate their interest. So they can indicate if they're interested in one of those alternate programs or an alternate campus. But at the end of the day, because we have such flexibility with our academic programs, we allow students to very much seamlessly transition from one school to another if they change their mind. Because of that, we aim to admit a Northeastern student, not a, you know, College of Arts, Media and Design student or Des Moines McKim School of Business student. So because of that, we're able to then allow students to move across majors easily. It really is, it's very much kept kind of an open door policy. Once once you're in, kind of the doors are open and you're able to kind of move from major to major. But it's all through that initial one application.
Is that, I mean, I assume that's not the case for engineering because it sort of never is, but what about computer science or business? Is there some flexibility to move into those fields?
Yes, I mean, we aim for every program at the university to have flexibility and the capacity to enroll students if they decide to change their mind and want to study in either. You might need to complete some core kind of prerequisite courses, but for the most part, we very much want a flexible curriculum that allows for kind of the full degree of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent, because it's become a lot of campuses, you don't apply into computer science, you're not getting in.
Right.
Or you might get into business, but only if you have a 3.5, which, let's face it, one bad case of mono or some illness in your first year, and that knocks that GPA down. Nothing against you, you know, it's
It's nice to see that they're able to transition from one to the other.
Yeah, that's excellent. All right. Well, any last words? Or I think this was extremely helpful.
No. It was a pleasure to be here. You know, we're very much looking forward to reading applications from the students who are coming in this year. They've already started pouring in, and we just started reading last week. So it's been exciting for us, and we're excited to see how the rest of the year goes.
Okay. Yes. Very. I'm excited, too. I have students applying to Northeastern as well. So.
Yeah, we just started reading last week.
Yeah. No, I always tell them they worry about if their teacher recs are in one day late, and I'm like, they're not reading
fine,
yet. They've got other stuff to do. So don't stress out about that. All right.
Well, thank you. Know if it really is missing. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Bo. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Hey, thank you.
All right. So we'll be taking a short break and then welcoming Wally Boudet to talk about quirky scholarships.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
College admissions can be stressful, but Bright Horizons College Coach is here to help.
Our college experts, who worked in admissions and financial aid at some of the nation's most selective institutions, offer ethical, customized assistance based on each student's individual strengths and interests. Students receive one-on-one guidance throughout the process, and our 100% success rate means all of our students have been accepted to college. Visit getintocollege.com to learn more. When it's time to go through the college admissions process, look to Bright Horizons College Coach for ethical guidance and customized support. Our educators will get to know your students' ambitions and talents, help highlight hard-won achievements, and create a plan for getting into a top-choice school. That plan includes helping your student choose classes and extracurriculars, create a college list, brainstorm and edit essays, and navigate college financing options. Visit getintocollege.com to learn more.
We're with you wherever Alexa and Google are. At home, in the car, on your smart TV, and your connected devices.
Hey, Alexa.
Hey, Google. Play my favorite Voice America podcast on TuneIn.
It's just that easy. But make sure you actually mention the name of the podcast show to make it work.
You are listening to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation. To submit a question for an upcoming listener Q&A segment or to suggest an idea for a future segment, please send an email to gettingin.voiceamerica@gmail.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome, Wally.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us today, and I am looking forward to this one. I mean, you always hear sort of rumors about quirky scholarships, and then you're like, well, that can't really be true, and then sometimes they are.
Exactly. There's some really, really interesting ones out there that you hear and you think that this can't be real. Mm-hmm. And indeed they are. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think I've heard that there's actually, well, we know that there's thousands of scholarships. So let's talk, though, about, I know people think a lot of them are undiscovered, but I think you can find a lot of them online at this point too, right?
Absolutely. There are several sites that give access to many of these, whether they're quirky or whether they're run of the mill. So that's part of what I'm going to mention. But since we're talking about quirky, let's talk about that. You know, we've heard this has been like this mythological left-handed scholarship. And honestly, and I just did a web search a few minutes ago, there are probably about a dozen of those that are focused on Southpaws, you know, whether they're from different schools or from different regions or anything like that. And many of these things are worth a lot of money. So it's really good for people to check up on it, really good to investigate and to go depth, especially if you're looking to fill those financial gaps. We'll talk a little bit more about the search in a second, but some of the really interesting ones that I came across was this first one I love. So Duck Brand Duct Tape, you know, DUCK Brand Duct Tape offers a Stuck at Prom scholarship. Any guess, any thought about what that might be?
Oh, wait. I think I've heard of this. If you have to make a prom dress out of duct tape, right?
You've got to make a prom dress and or a tux out of their brand duct tape. Obviously, high resolution photos come into play well. Probably branding comes into play. But this is a really out there scholarship that is so interesting. And here's the cool thing. Obviously, listen, it is limited, but the winner for both the gown and the tux, so separate winners, get 10 grand.
Wow. 10 grand. So it's not nothing. This is not a little $500. I mean, $500 is $500, but 10 grand.
10 grand to make a duct tape piece of clothing. Interesting. Yeah. And now they do have some runners up that are awarded $500 scholarships, but if you are artsy and if you're thinking about doing something that's a little bit out there and this may have been in your mind, what the heck? Mm-hmm. Hey, brand it up and let's see what you can get. 10 grand might be worth it for you to check out.
Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, it could be part of your art portfolio potentially. You know?
Absolutely. So another one that I wanted to mention, and the name is kind of funny, but when you think about it, it's really not. It's called the Asparagus Club Scholarship. Hmm. And this is a cool one because the National Grocers Association awards 10 scholarships of $2,000 per semester for 2 years. So $8,000 over 2 years, that's not a bad thing, really. And I was going to mention this later, but we can talk about it now. Most private scholarships are non-recurring, meaning they're only good for that one period. So to get guaranteed funding into a second year is a really, really nice thing. But for these kids, they've got to be earning a degree in business, food management, or other relevant courses, leading it to a career in the grocery industry. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people think about their career or future going into the grocery industry. However, if you've got family members that are brought up in it, or you've got a family, although these are, you know, few and far between now, family grocery store, anything like that, something that might be out there for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, or I could see someone who, you know, started out of high school working at a grocery store, likes the industry. People are telling him he or she have room to move up and this is, you know, go to college and, you know, continue working maybe, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there again, sounds odd, but when it comes down to it, not necessarily odd, more mainstream than you would think. The key of it is to dig. Private scholarship searches are not easy. So moving on to the next one, we've got the Illinois Organization of Mothers of Twins Club. And that's self-explanatory, okay? There is an actual group in Illinois that is the Illinois Organization of Mothers of Twins Clubs, and they give out scholarships to both mothers of multiples and children that are multiples. And so there's a two-stage area of award there. How many moms are going back to school? Well, that's kind of to be determined, but interesting scholarship there. Not really lucrative, $250 to the parents, $150 to the kids, but since we're talking about quirky scholarship, what the heck? It sounds like something that was real good.
Yeah.
The last one is the oddest one that I could find out. This is called the CORE Memorial Scholarship. And this is really, really out there. Think about Star Trek. Think about Spock, okay? The Klingon Language Council awards $500 scholarships to students who excel at implementing creative uses for the language of Klingon.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
I didn't realize that there was such a depth of development and investigation into Klingon.
You obviously haven't been watching the Big Bang Theory reruns, Wally.
but there again, I think one of the most important things about this is that there are scholarships out there that fit so many different people that people don't know what to look for or how to look for. And that just shows that there may be stuff that fits everyone. You've just got to be persistent and directed to search. So
I've told students even to, like, you know, find local charitable organizations and reach out to them. Maybe they have something, you know, and they're not often those smaller organizations are not as good at advertising stuff. It's just not their priority. They don't have someone who does marketing. But if you reach out to them and they have $500, you might be a top priority to get that.
Absolutely. And when we have conversations with families to talk about schools, private scholarships are one of the primary sources of funding college. The first place that we tell families to look is our local resources. You know, if only because local or regional resources, you're probably going to have a lower count of applicants. Just off the bat, improves your odds from there. Okay. If you know someone who's associated with any of those groups, be it, as you mentioned, a local benevolent society or a church, or mom and dad may be in a professional networking group, or you may have the relative or parents, you may have the coworker who participated in everything. There's a pretty decent likelihood that one of those groups is going to offer something in scholarship. So this is a social outreach kind of thing with regard to this is, hey, I understand that you work with this group and I understand that they've got this scholarship. Is there anything that you could help me with regard to that?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's giving me a recommendation or even an informal referral, anything that you can help me with, I'd be most appreciative. So,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, local is best. And also, as you go through many towns, you'll see the signs up for the Lions Club and the Rotary Club and the Kiwanis Club and all of these. And I bet if I went and checked right now, all of those groups have, in one form or another, scholarships to give. Whether they're state or local or national, chances are there's money associated with those. And so use all of the resources that you've got. And there again, realize that local increases odds, because once you go into a national search, you're competing against thousands, thousands of other people. And so the odds there are just not great if you're really needing the money. Focus on where the odds are going to be better for you.
Exactly. Yeah, I was a high school counselor and I worked at a school in Southern California. And, you know, we had students, I always encourage students to apply to these small private scholarships because they might literally only have 20 people applying.
Sure, exactly.
You know, so your odds are so much better than for the Coca-Cola scholarship.
Yeah,
where,
exactly.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, but your chances of getting something is almost nothing.
There is a $10,000 no essay scholarship, national scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine how many people are applying for that. That's like the lotto that was at $1 billion or whatever last year.
Yeah.
I mean, the odds of that are just absolutely ridiculous. And so you've got to be strategic and targeted with the stuff like this. So, since we're talking about national search as well, there are a couple of sites that we generally refer families to.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has a really odd name. It's Going, like G-O-I-N-G, and Merry, like Merry Christmas, M-E-R-R-Y, goingmerry.com. The other one is simple. It's scholarships.com, scholarship with an S on the end, .com. And for both of these cases, we recommend families do both reactive and proactive searches. Proactive by looking for scholarships such as this Asparagus Club scholarship or this Klingon scholarship that fits who you are. Are you redheaded? Are you left-handed? Are you studying in a certain thing? Ethnicity might come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Need in many cases might come into play. So there may be some expression that you've got to give regarding income and such like that. Reactive, on the other hand, is that creating a profile with the scholarship search site and allowing the scholarship site to ostensibly match you with scholarships that fit you. The key there is that you've really got to be diligent in reviewing the requirements of that scholarship to make sure that you fit the requirements of it. If they've got five requirements and you only fill three and it's a national scholarship, you may be wasting your time in order to do that. Or on the counter of that is that if the award is $500 and they're asking you for three letters of recommendation and two essays, again, hey, any money is good money. Any free money is better money. But there may be better options for you that may provide you with better odds and a better fit for that individual scholarship. So that's where it gets a little bit dicey.
Yeah. So Wally, unfortunately, I have to close this off now. We got to end the segment. But thank you so much. It was so interesting to hear about all this. And I think your advice is really good. Proactive and reactive.
And local.
And local. Very important. Absolutely. All right. So everyone, we'll be doing a repeat for our Thanksgiving show, but for the December 1st show, Elizabeth Heaton will be starting our new series on niche colleges with St. John's of Maryland and Santa Fe. And that's a great book, College, really interesting place. And then answering listener questions with our regular finance contributor, Shannon Vasconcelos. And finally, I want to remind you that you don't have to listen to our shows live. Every show is accessible 24/7 on the Voice America website. And you can also download every show for free on iTunes. Please rate us, by the way, so more people can find us. And don't forget, we're here every Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific.
Thank you for tuning in to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation, hosted by Elizabeth Heaton and the team of experts at Bright Horizons College Coach. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Have a good week.